Hello and welcome to The Fergan. My name is Dan and I'm here to try and make sense of these turbulent times from a heathen perspective. Visit fergan.com for links, information and an archive of past episodes. Hello folks and welcome to episode number 10 of the Fergan podcast. This will be an AMA, Ask Me Anything episode, and it's the first time I've ever done an AMA really. So I put out a post on Telegram and on Subscribestar, Patreon and Substack asking supporters if they'd like to put forth a question on, well, pretty much anything really. I've had some good questions in and I've compiled them into a list, but not really read through them. So this will be quite a spontaneous response to them. So if you hear an unusual edit in the audio, it's probably because I've had to spend too long thinking about the answer to a question and have perhaps paused recording to go away and think about it a bit longer. But for the most part, I think I should be able to answer these off the bat, and hopefully my answers can serve as some kind of, valuable insight, maybe. So the first question is from JL. I want to get more active in my spiritual practice and just build a feeling for being pagan. I'm visiting many local forests and taking it all in as often as possible. Letting go of my pretenses is something I'm practicing to see if I can let in more signs. Well, I think JL's doing absolutely the right thing by connecting strongly with nature. I have always found forests to be particularly magical environments myself. Some people are more drawn to the coast, some to mountains, some to, you know, rivers, some to moors, and, you know, or all of the above. But for me, forests are always the place where I seek the strongest connection with nature. I think just by doing that, you start to see the world in a different way. You know, by connecting with that timeless, ancient aspect of the human experience, you know, the natural world around us. Beyond that, I think meditation is a really key first step. You know, you may find that if you are able to go into a deep enough meditation that you can even access what feels and seems to be like, you know, an altered state of consciousness or a spirit world. That's something that I felt I've experienced. And they say that you never have a more vivid or potent, you know, otherworld journey than your first one. And that was definitely the case for me. But even if you don't achieve that sort of level of altered state, you can, often, even in a light meditation, you can find answers to questions that you've been seeking. That's because, and that's a very pagan concept because, you know, our belief is that we tap into this kind of collective folk consciousness, this stream of tradition, and that our knowledge is connected to the knowledge of our ancestors. So by switching off the five senses to as great an extent as possible and focusing inward, I should say, you can often tap into those resources. And an example I can give of that is some of you may have read my essay, Alu, The Secrets of Alu. And many of the ideas that I put across in that essay, which I still think, you know, are quite valuable, those came to me in a state of meditation. You know, so just meditating with a specific symbol or question or idea in mind, these things can start coming to you and you start to see the connections between different symbols, and you see the connections between what you're focused on and what starts to appear before you and be talked about, you know, synchronistically by other people. Music is another thing. I mean, for me, music has always been very intrinsic to my pagan worldview. You know, I can to go out in an evening with headphones on, listening to some, you know, what I would consider to be very kind of, you know, almost transcendental music, even if it's black metal, that can really shift my mindset away from kind of the mundane world. And I have some very vivid memories of these walks, you know, beneath a full moon, listening to, and I can tell you exactly which albums I was listening to. You know, I have very vivid memories of these times. And during those times, I feel a connection with spirit. You could spend the night camping near sacred sites like stone circles or burial mounds and see what feelings arise, see what atmospheres are evoked in those situations. You may even experience something tangible and paranormal. Bloat, especially with others, can be a very very powerful experience. I wouldn't even rule out entheogens. You know, I don't have great experience with this, and I don't promote them heavily, but I'm also not dead against them. I mean, I only really have one experience. I consumed some Liberty Cap mushrooms last year for the first and only time, and although I wouldn't say that it was it put me into not a kind of overtly altered state of consciousness, it did help me to see things in quite a new light. You know, people talk about plant teachers, and although that's kind of a bit of a cliche, I do think it's a good term for it, because under the influence of certain traditional, you know, whether it be fungi or you know, plants or herbs, I do think that you can be taught a lot during those experiences. But overall, I think you have to see your kind of journey it's a journey. It's not, and I did actually answer this question in the private Telegram group that we have, so I'm kind of reiterating here, but it's not an on-off switch. You don't click something and become pagan. It's a journey. It's a self-initiatory process. It's an alchemical process. That's how I see it. You know, you have to make the move to start shifting your entire worldview towards that traditional pagan mindset. And as you do that, you find that experiences start to match your worldview. You find that the knowledge that is given to you starts to complement that mindset. And before you know it, everything you do and everything you say and everything you write starts to come from a place of, you know, that folkish tradition. And I don't think any of us will ever achieve that fully in our lifetimes. You know, it's a very long process. It's perhaps a multi incarnation process. But yeah, anyway, hope that helps. JL had another question. Could you talk more about your path down the conspiracy rabbit hole? I've come across Alan Watts, who talks about the big guys such as Alex Jones and David Icke essentially being red herrings meant to mix the truth up with crazy talk to discredit the parts of the truth they do speak. How did it unfold for you? It wasn't one thing, it was a collection of things, and I believe that those things happen for a reason. Probably the first thing would have been 9/11. You know, I was at college at the time, and I witnessed the planes hitting those towers on the news, and I saw the BBC reporter reporting that Building 7 had fallen while it was still standing in the background. You know, I saw that firsthand, Well, I say firsthand, I mean through the television screen. And I knew instinctively, particularly the plane that supposedly hit the Pentagon, I knew when I saw that, that there was something not right about what I was being told through all of that. That was a huge wake-up call for me. And, you know, I think in much the same way, this COVID scam is proving to be a huge wake-up call for, you know, younger generations, maybe even older generations. But whatever the case, it's a good thing from that point of view. I was introduced to the book Fingerprints of the Gods by Graham Hancock, and that was a big one as well. And that's why I've recommended this book to people. It is a good book, and I do think it's enjoyable. It's not flawless, and I'm not saying that I buy into all of the conclusions or theories put forth wholeheartedly, not for a moment. But what it did teach me is that our ancient ancestors were not the knuckle-dragging, illiterate, dumb, ignorant, backwards dinosaurs that we have been raised to believe that they were. In fact, it leaves you with the feeling that they were far wiser than we are today in this modern world. And when you couple that that knowledge with the concept of Kali Yuga, you know, this idea that we are in a descended or degraded age, that we were once healthier, wiser, more beautiful, more in tune with one another and with the earth and all of these things, you know, more so than we are now. I said before that there isn't a switch that you can flick to become pagan, but maybe there is, because for me, that realization was something of a switch, you know, that realization that actually our pagan ancestors, our ancient pagan ancestors, knew more about the world, about nature, about existence, about human interaction, about physics and mathematics and the power of language and psychology than we do today. That's a pivotal realization. And that is, I suppose, that's the moment when I came to reappraise paganism and think, well, you know, if what this book says is true, and I feel like it is, then why would I not turn to the oldest tradition of my people that I know of, because therein lies greater wisdom than in the modern age. I've kind of gone off on a bit of a tangent here, but yeah, the conspiracy rabbit hole, I mean, from 9/11 and Graham Hancock, and then it went to, yeah, the usual culprits, David Icke, Alex Jones. I used to sit at work in my first job listening to InfoWars every day. And in hindsight, I mean, InfoWars is, I think it was actually better back then. I mean, these days, Alex Jones is, you know, he just shills for Trump and stuff like that. But back then, there was real talk of this kind of technocratic takeover and of forced vaccinations and all things which have, you know, come to be or are coming to be now, whatever it is, you know, 20 years later. David Icke, I think, yeah, I'm not keen on this idea that David Icke should be discarded because he throws in some bad information. The bad information is, I mean, that's down to one's discretion, you know, the whole idea of reptilians. I'm not going to comment on that, but what I would say is that I think people misinterpret what he's saying quite a lot. I don't know what the truth about David Icke is. I don't know how genuine he is, but I will say that I have learnt a lot from him. So I would never entirely throw him under the bus. Alan Watt, I only have a passing familiarity with, but I got into Red Ice quite early on. I used to listen to Red Ice before they went alt-right. And I was particularly interested in the shows they did with Michael Tsarian and John Lamlash. And, you know, a few other, you know, regular guests. And I just found the information that they were presenting mind-blowing. Yeah, that was really important stuff. And, yeah, I mean, from there, you know, where does it go? yeah, you get deeper and deeper and things get more and more controversial, really. And you come across information that you really don't want to believe, frankly. And I think many of you know what I'm talking about there. But if you are a genuine truth seeker and, you know, truth is your highest goal, then you have a duty to follow that truth wherever it may lead. And I still live by that now. And I've always sworn to myself that I would follow the truth wherever it may lead. Another question from JL. What moments in your musical career are you most proud of? And have you any goals you've yet to achieve? I feel now like I've really achieved, and I mean, I've achieved far more than I ever expected to, particularly with Walkensman. When I started Walkensman, it was meant to be a rough 3-track demo, and I handmade 30 CDs, which I gave to friends, and that was meant to be it. I did not expect to make any music beyond that. So, you know, fast forward 9 years now, and, you know, I've done a European tour as a solo performer, something I never thought I'd have the courage to do, let alone the opportunity. I have, what are some of my biggest achievements? The Pagan Futures event last weekend was wonderful, I think, because very few musicians get the opportunity to combine their kind of passions and their faith with their music in the way that I was able to at Pagan Futures. You know, I performed for a room of mostly, you know, devout pagans, and was then given the opportunity to share my thoughts on some related subject matters. You know, it was a unique and special experience, and, you know, the people I met on the evening were, you know, wonderful, and it was great. With Winterfillith, I did some big things with Winterfillith. You know, we did several European tours while I was in the band. One of my favourite performances was playing a festival called, at the time it was called Funkenflug, and it was on a mountain in the Austrian Alps. And, you know, I can still remember being on stage and just looking out and seeing this incredible alpine vista stretched out before me. Yeah, that was amazing. What else has there been? God, I mean, I could go through so many things. I almost feel like I could do a whole podcast just on, you know, my experiences as a musician, really, and maybe I will do that. Goals that I feel I've yet to achieve. I would love to have toured America, or even just played a festival in America. Unfortunately, it was never on the cards with Winterfillith, because one of the members was not keen on flying. So even though we had offers, it never happened. There was someone who was trying to bring Walkensman over to America, but I mean, for a start, I don't think that they could afford to cover my costs to do that. And I wasn't in a position to cover them myself. And then, you know, 2020 happened, and, you know, any possibility of that happening went out the window then. I don't know if I'll ever get a chance to do that, but, you know, And, you know, this is an example of seeing things through a pagan worldview. You know, it's taught me the importance of stoicism. You know, my view now is, you know, it just wasn't on the cards. It was not part of my weird to do that, or it may not have been part of my weird. If it turns out that I never perform in America, then that's just how it was written, or how it was, you know, how the threads of weird were woven. Perhaps pre-pagan, I would have been angrier and more bitter about it. But now I try to focus on the wonderful experiences that I have been granted rather than what I've missed out on. And, you know, the musical landscape is so different now to what it was even 10 years ago, that these old dreams that people like me grow up with of being, you know, a professional musician, you know, touring the world and, you know, making records every couple of years, which sell, you know, tens or even hundreds of thousands of copies. I mean, those are just, those dreams have basically been destroyed for all but the very most fortunate and hardworking musicians. So I don't feel too cynical about that, because it's just, it's the way that the world has changed, and there old opportunities die and new ones arise. And I've seen the last 2 years and, you know, my efforts with the Fergan as an opportunity. You know, I'll probably never play or speak to, you know, 50,000 people, you know, in one evening, like, you know, some of the bands that I grew up idolizing have done. But, you know, I'll take quality over quantity any day. And, you know, if there are 10 people listening to this podcast who get value from it, then that means just as much to me as performing at a festival to 50,000 people who barely care, you know. And one last question from JL. He's got quite a few in, but that's fine. In what areas are the dissident sphere lacking? What blind spots do we have, and what doesn't get discussed enough? I came to the kind of dissident nationalist sphere via conspiracy theory, in inverted commas. So I've always, you know, and this goes back to the early 2000s. So for at least 15 years now, I have held these views. And most of that time, I have been deeply frustrated at how nationalists have this inability to consider that what they are being told by the mainstream media may not be the truth. For example, the multitude of Islamic terror attacks that we've seen over the last 20 years, you know, up to and including 9/11. 9/11 was not committed by Islamic terrorists. Okay, I'm sorry if you think it was, it just wasn't. Neither was 7/7 in London, the bombing of the buses and the underground. And I strongly believe that most of the so-called Islamic terror attacks are staged events. You can often tell if there are photos in the mainstream media of shoes, strange placement of shoes mysteriously left about the crime scene. This seems to be a calling card for the the architects of these staged events. But I've got myself in trouble a lot over the years for trying to suggest this. I mean, back at the, you know, and let me just preface this by saying that I have no ill will towards Muslims whatsoever. In fact, in recent years, I would say that I've come to actually quite appreciate most of the Muslims that I've ever known. That said, in my more naive days, and in being frustrated with the drastically changing demographic of my country, I was quite excited when the EDL came along. In the very early days of the EDL, I was actually enlisted to write articles for the website, the official EDL website, that is. I wrote a couple of articles, and I was a regular on the forum there. And one day I had the tenacity to write a forum thread about the Rothschilds and their grip on central banking, and how this is just as much, if not more, of a threat to us than this Islamic grooming and whatnot, whatever was being touted in the news at the time. My post was removed within minutes, and I was given a lifetime ban, and that was it, gone. I was never to work with the EDL again. And I realized at that moment that the EDL is a PSYOP. It's an organization created by nefarious forces for nefarious reasons, namely for Zionist purposes. So, I've bumped heads a lot with patriots and nationalists over the years who just do not appreciate my suggestion that, you know, for example, Islamic terror attacks may not be what they seem to be, and that maybe we're being encouraged to build this kind of, ferment this friction between you know, the native English population and Muslim immigrants. And yeah, I won't go deep into that because, again, that could take a long time. That's definitely probably the biggest blind spot in the dissident sphere, but that has changed a lot over the last 2 years. Thankfully, I've enormously pleased to see that nationalists have softened up immensely to the idea of so-called conspiracy theories. And I'm also proud to say that I played a part in making that happen. Right, so next question comes from Orindil. I have the following question. If the gods have historically shown themselves to their folk, why do different Indo-European people see them differently? Why is Wotan Odin Woden, an old one-eyed man followed by two ravens and two wolves, according to the Germanic tradition, whilst Lugus, Luch, Clu is usually remembered as a young warrior god by the Celts? If it's the same god, why has he taken a different shape when showing himself to followers of Celtic, Germanic, Roman, etc. paganism? Do these different perceptions just come from oral tradition, or could we assume that it's just that the gods evolve with their folk? Like when you encountered Woden, I suppose he was dressed in somewhat modern clothes and he spoke modern English, whilst I suppose he'd speak modern German if he encountered a Bavarian guy. Could we say that? Could we say the same possibly happened at some point in prehistoric ancient times? Yeah, this is a really good question and a big one to answer. From my perspective, I mean, Orindil has pretty much answered his own question there, I would say. The gods appear to their folk in a way which is most acceptable to the folk. That's probably the simplest way I can put it. I think the gods realize the perceptions and expectations made of them, and they realize what they embody in to the human eye. And I think in order to appease our sense of expectation, they will appear to us in a way which is acceptable to us. You know, rather than to be shocking or to appear in a manner which we find confusing or, you know, perhaps even jarring and, you know, off-putting, I think that they will appear in a way which is acceptable to us. And I think that's what happened with me. You know, if Woden had appeared to myself and my three cohorts that evening with one missing eye, with a wide-brimmed hat, with two ravens upon his shoulders, then I think the purpose of his manifestation would have been ruined, because we would have instantly known who it was. And I think part of what happened that evening was that we were supposed to go away and meditate for days, weeks, months upon what we had experienced, and to come to a conclusion. It was almost a test of faith. It was kind of like, I'm going to appear to you, and I'm not going to appear in a way that's too obvious, but I want to see if you know who I am anyway, you know? And I think we can kind of extrapolate that back through history. You know, our ancestors, the stories that they relay of Woden or Luch or Clu, you know, he is known in the Celtic lands, the stories that they pass down of these gods, that they are based on experiences that were had either in the material realm with the manifestation of these gods, or through an altered state of consciousness. And there are always going to be kind of a discrepancy in the details when we, because there isn't, you know, when we enter the spirit world, or we enter an altered state of consciousness, and we encounter, you know, one of our gods, we are, you know, what would you call it, interfacing, to use computer language. We are interfacing with a non-human form. So we don't, in order to, in order for that god or goddess to make sense to us, we have to kind of fill in the missing pieces. We have to create a human form to represent them, you know, in our, using our creative abilities. It's a difficult thing to describe, but hopefully you get what I'm trying to say there. So I think there is an element of, when we encounter the gods, there is an element of our own fabrication that comes into it. You know, we project some of our own expectations on that deity, because that deity is not human. It doesn't usually exist in human form, with human clothing, with human styling, in human shape, you know. So we kind of build this character around the energy that is that god. I think that's probably the best answer I can give to that answer right now, but it's, as I say, it's a really good question, and it's something that I'm going to go away thinking about. Adam's question is, what is your approach to morality? Do you see it as universal or particular? Is it absolute or relative? Do right and wrong exist at a universal level? And do you see a relationship between the collective moral behaviour of society and their level of freedom? So I think I pretty much gave my thoughts on this in my... partly in the podcast episode, which I think was number 4, about the film The Northman, but also partly in a Telegram post that I did in response to a post which Morgoth's Review made, questioning the lack of kind of objective morality in the film. So, briefly, just to reiterate what I said there, our ancestors didn't have an idea of universal morality. Morality was based on what is good for your folk. And that worked in kind of concentric circles. You know, firstly, what is good for your immediate family, for your wife and your children, or your husband and your children, or your siblings and your parents. And then what is good for your brothers, your sisters, you know, your extended family. And then from there, what is good for your, you know, the community that you live within. And then behind that, what is good for the tribe, and then behind that, the kingdom, and then behind that, the, you know, the wider race or ethnic group. So there was no such thing as universal morality, and I don't think people were concerned with being good men, you know, in a kind of universal objective sense. Being a good man was, you know, being able to provide for and protect your tribe. That's what goodness was to our pagan ancestors. Now, I would say that my personal beliefs are both sympathetic to that, but also perhaps go a little bit beyond that, because I do believe that there is such thing as an objective good. For a start, objective good is, living in harmony with nature and the natural order. I believe that it is good to be wise. It is good to be compassionate. It is good to cause as little suffering as possible. So I think how I would put it is that I agree with our ancestors in everything but their sense of violence, perhaps. I think I would say that my morality matches our pagan ancestors' morality quite precisely, except for the fact that I don't think it's acceptable to reeve, as the border reavers of England and Scotland did, to travel, you know, 10 miles over the hill and just steal from the settlement that belongs there. I think that was probably done out of necessity during very harsh times for our ancestors. And it was literally a case of, well, if you don't do that, you don't survive. And there's a certain kind of, there is a certain survival of the fittest aspect to that, in that, and there almost is a kind of objective morality, because you, I suppose, you are subconsciously taking the view that if you want what's best for humanity or for your wider ethnic group as a whole, then you believe that the best man should win, because the best man or the best band of reavers or the best side in a battle will then go on to create more families who will be stronger and more ruthless and more able to cope with the harshness of the world. So there is almost a kind of natural eugenics in this idea of reaving and stealing from rivaling groups. It's kind of different in the modern age, and it's difficult with our modern society to take that view, because we are right now not in a position where we need to act like that, where we need to behave like that. But I will say that if I ever am in a position where, you know, I have to choose, you know, whether, you know, I want to be compassionate towards a neighbouring settlement or to feed my immediate family, I will absolutely choose to feed my family. And that is my morality. I think, really, from a kind of universal cosmic point of view, morality is that the highest, most important form of morality is to honour the natural order, to uphold and maintain the natural order, and to respect Mother Earth and the gods. So I think it's possible to do all of that whilst also being quite violent and ruthless when that's required of you. You know, I mean, you know, I sit here saying this as someone who doesn't eat any meat or currently any dairy any animal products whatsoever. It's even been about a year since I ate eggs. I don't consider myself vegan because I don't like the label and I don't like the connotations of it, but I've not eaten meat since I was 15 years old. So that's well over half my life. So I do believe in compassion, and I do believe in causing as little suffering as possible. But that's only because it's no, you know, it's no skin off my back to do that, to live like that in this modern age. If I'm in a position where I have to consume animals in order to survive, I will do it, no problem. You know, it's just at this point, I am able to thrive without doing so, and that enables me to cause less suffering than I believe is necessary, so I'll do it. You know, that's pretty much my morality in a nutshell. Another question from Adam. How did you introduce pagan ideas to your children, and how do you navigate the hostility of the world while still hoping to maintain their innocence? Another very good question. My children were all named at heathen naming ceremonies with other members of the group that I practice with, that I moot with. So we introduced them to that very early on. And my wife is not as overtly pagan as I am. I mean, she is in spirit, you know, excuse the pun. She is in spirit a pagan, definitely, but she struggles with the rigid sort of, you know, I'm not going to say dogma, because that is a word that's better reserved for the Abrahamic religions, but she struggles with the kind of the boundaries that exist within paganism and the kind of more rigid aspects of it, of mundane ritual. And I think she also feels that she wouldn't have the confidence to explain to someone that she knows why she is a pagan, you know. But we essentially raise our children as pagan. You know, we have books that we read them. They have a book called The Animals of Yggdrasil. We have Tom Rousell's book, which, forgive me, I forget the name of right now, about the spirit of, I think it's called the spirit of Yule, I believe the book is called. which is about the spirit of Yule. And, you know, we read these books to them and have done since an early age. So they've grown up with these ideas. I mean, two of my children, actually, their names include the names of heathen gods. So, and, you know, all children will ask about their names from a young age. So they've known from early on that they are connected with these gods and traditions by their very names. And, you know, we playfully tell them when there's a thunderstorm that it's Thunor or Thor, you know, stomping in the clouds. And we tell them that, my song Sunna, the Walkensman song, which, you know, many of you may know from the intro of Survive the Jive videos, that song was written when my eldest daughter I was carrying her on my back. I think she was probably about 2 years old, maybe even a little bit younger. She'd just learned to speak, and we were walking the dogs one evening, and the sun was setting, you know, above the crest of a hill. And I said to her, I said, you know, good night, sun, good night, sunna. And she picked up on that very, very quickly, and she began to get emotional and sad that the sun was going to bed, you know. So this kind of anthropomorphizing of the natural elements and things, this is something that they've been brought up with from a young age, and they have a deep connection with nature. They love being outdoors and identifying herbs and plants and playing with bugs and snails and things like that. You know, they're not squeamish at all about that stuff. They've got a very close connection with nature. They love going to the heathen moots that we do. They love learning about the runes. You know, they've got bracelets which a good friend of ours made for them. You know, they know it's important to me, and therefore it's important to them. You know, they children are like that. You know, they pick up on what their parents are authentically passionate about, and they show an interest in those same things. How do we intend to navigate the hostility of the world while hoping to maintain their innocence? That's a really good question. I don't know how successful we'll be. I mean, my oldest is 9. They are allowed to watch some television. We don't have an aerial, but they are allowed to watch certain YouTube videos Blu-ray discs or downloaded films, things like that. So we're very selective about what we allow them to watch and how much of their time they are allowed to spend watching that stuff. We won't be buying them smartphones. That will never happen. I'm yet to introduce them to the world of computers, but that's inevitable because we homeschool them, and I think that having a computer will be very useful in that. But again, we will monitor as closely as we can what they have access to, and I think they've got a good instinct already naturally, and I think they have picked up on mine and my wife's anxieties about the modern world and the things that we dislike about the modern world, and in an effort to impress us, they echo our views on those things. So I hope that that continues. I am aware that there will probably come a time where they'll begin to rebel. And I think at that point, it will be a case of letting the leash out, but not too far. And just making it, being very open with them, having some very candid conversations with them, explaining to them why we are opposed to certain things, and why we want to keep them separated from certain things. I think being honest is the most important thing. And I hope that, you know, even through doing these podcasts, I'm developing an ability to explain why these principles are important. And I will be able to use that ability on my own children at some point. So yeah, TBC really. To be confirmed. I'll report back in a few years' time on that one. Next question. Got 3 more. Next question is from Itinerant. I am just interested if you have any recommendations for Anglo-Saxon history to get the uninitiated, or should I say disconnected, reconnected with their traditions. books, podcasts, language courses, whatever. I feel like a weed poking at the concrete roof to burst through right now. I can sympathize with this a lot. You know, I've been at this point where I'm just hungry for knowledge about my identity. A big help in that was the publisher AS Books, Anglo-Saxon Books. A really good publisher. They've done some great books, which I have several of. They publish books by people like Stephen Pollington, and I forget the name of the author, but I have a book called Plain English. I think the author is called Brian Evans, if I remember rightly. Plain English is a book which is basically a dictionary which will give you a pure English or Anglo-Saxon derived word for almost any word in the modern language. So I use this book a lot writing lyrics for Walkinsman, because all lyrics are written using English or using words which are derived from Old English only. Stuff like that is really helpful. That's a really good reference book. It gets you thinking about history and your identity in a new way. You know, you think about words a lot. Even when you're using words, or you come across a new word, or someone says a word that you've not heard in a long time, you know, you start to mull over in your mind, you know, what's the origin of that word? What's the etymology? And I've always been very interested in etymology. And, you know, so you're getting to grips with the origin of your language. So that's one tradition, language. I mean, I've never gone down the route of LARPing, you know, or you know, joining groups which dress in the traditional Anglo-Saxon style or anything like that. I think you learn about the runes. A great book specifically for the English runes is Rudiments of Rune Lore by Stephen Pollington, which again is on AS Books, and that's a great reference book to learn about the English approach to the history of the runes in England. Podcast is not something I'm admittedly quite ignorant of the podcast scene, even though I have this podcast. And I do apologize to any of the great podcasts out there, the heathen ones or the ones based, you know, who are based on Anglo-Saxon or British or European or, you know, whatever identity and history. I just haven't really spent much time exploring the world of podcasts, so I can't recommend anything there. Language courses. I mean, I'm really hoping that a good friend of mine, Whityard, who has a channel on Telegram, he is so deeply knowledgeable on language and particularly Old English and the English language. And he really should be teaching. He should be teaching what he knows, because he is deeply knowledgeable. And he's actually going to be a guest probably on the next episode of the podcast. So I'll keep chipping away at him and get him to maybe set something up, or he could perhaps offer some suggestions or, you know, for me to share on the Telegram channel. Yeah, what else is there to connect with Anglo-Saxon history? I mean, I always go on about it, but the books, The Real Middle Earth and The Way of Weird by Brian Bates, for me were so important because they brought to life the Anglo-Saxon pagan world. They brought that world to life in a way which I'd never known before. And whatever inaccuracies there might be in those books, it doesn't matter, really. You can go off and you can verify what's true and what isn't afterwards, but it just gives you a sense of the worldview that our ancestors had, this mystical, magical, like, wonderful, wide world that they perceived, and the connections and the opportunities and the magic and wonder in that world. And I think, speaking for myself, if I hadn't had that world brought to life for me, then I wouldn't be interested in any of the academic explorations of Anglo-Saxon identity at all, because all of that is so dry, and dry academic material doesn't appeal to me. I'm sorry, you know, with all due respect to those who make videos and write articles and books on that stuff, it just doesn't resonate with me. I still read that stuff because I like to try and reinforce my knowledge, but it will never be my first point of call. It will never be the thing that inspires me. So I will always turn to fiction or semi-fiction, or folk tales or mythology or Beowulf or things like that to get a sense of my identity rather than these kind of more academic, dry treatises. Next question is from an old friend of mine, Connor Droney. Why do you think people like us are awake to the tyranny and corruption of the powers that be, and other so-called intelligent people are not? That is, that's the million-dollar question. Thanks for giving me such a tough one, Connor. I go back and forth on this one. I think there has to be something to the concept of the NPC, the non-playable character, the idea that there are certain humans which just don't have this kind of sense of agency within them. They don't appear to have this kind of spark of divinity within them. They seem to be empty shells who are just waiting to have their instructions loaded into them like some kind of boot drive by the prevailing mainstream narrative. And if that is true, it doesn't matter how academically intelligent people are or not, because academic intelligence is simply the ability to take in, store, and regurgitate facts. That's all it is. There's an enormous difference between, intelligence and wisdom, and most of the time they are mutually exclusive, I would say. Many intelligent people are not wise, and that's because they are intelligent because they went through their schooling period and their younger years never questioning why they had to take in the information that they do. Whereas those who questioned schooling and the curriculum and the things that were they were told were so important for them to learn when younger, those who question those things tend to be more open to true wisdom, which is more based on life experience, based on open-mindedness, the ability to change one's worldview based on new information. I've been listening to a very long series of podcasts by John Lamlash about the Mandela effect, which he recorded about 5 years ago. And one of the things he mentions repeatedly in there is that apparently, and I've not verified this myself, but apparently there is a statistic that 9 in 10 people do not have the ability to change their views when confronted with new contradicting information. And it seems true. It seems to add up to me, to be honest. The last 2 years have taught us that it doesn't matter how many times you present someone with information which destroys their false and slavish view, mainstream view of things. They just will not change their view. They will either find some irrelevant piece of information to try and contradict it, or they will mock what you're saying, or they will simply switch off, which is what happens most of the time, because they don't even have the energy or confidence to confront what you're saying. So they just switch off, and then the next time you speak to them a week later, you have a conversation on something similar, and they will act as though the previous conversation never happened. And I'm sure many of you listening to this have experienced that. I've experienced that. It's deeply frustrating. In contradiction to the NPC thing, I do sometimes wonder whether actually everybody does have the ability to nurture that divine kind of fire within them, that divine spark. I think probably this is what the attitude that we should be taking, and when I think back to the people who, including my brothers, I planted, bits of, I left them with bits of information. I planted seeds early on, and it just so happens that me and my two brothers are all pretty much on the same page, certainly with regards to the plandemic. So is that because of a genetic connection that we all have that ability? I don't think it is, because neither of our parents are on the same page. One of them isn't at all, and the other one is partly on the same page. So I don't see how it could be a genetic thing. So I think most, if not all people, do have the ability to see the tyranny and corruption of the powers that be. It's just a case of pulling them away from their television sets, their smartphones. Somehow we just need to find that right plant, that right seed to plant at the right time in the right way. And I think that if we can find that, then everyone is fair game. Everyone has the ability to wake up to what we realize. Being open-minded is an enormous part of it. You know, it's ironic how most of our so-called our opponents, who consider themselves liberal and progressive and open-minded, actually they are ignorant precisely because of how closed-minded they are. I'm not, you know, and when I say open-mindedness is a good thing, I don't mean in the sense that you should accept anything. I mean that you should consider anything. You know, and sometimes we can consider things which are very quickly refuted, whether by instinct or by facts. But sometimes there are things that, you know, we should be willing to listen to things that our opponents say, and actually maybe even spend, you know, a genuine bit of time considering what they say. But it's rare to come across that, because people like us do tend to, we've spent a lifetime, many of us, already looking into these matters, you know, making a hobby and a passion of looking into the hidden machinations of government and finance and politics and religion and things like that. Whereas the people who would, you know, denounce us as conspiracy theorists or crackpots or whatever, have not spent any time doing that. They don't read books even. They literally watch Netflix, you know, check in on their news websites once a day and regurgitate the points of view shared by their friends on Facebook. You know, they have not made an effort to dig deeper, to look beyond the surface level presentation of news and ideas. I hope that somewhat answers the question. It's a really difficult question to answer, and I don't know if anyone would be able to give a definitive answer to that one. Right, and sorry, just taking a drink before I read out the final question for this episode. And this is from Callum, who is a man who I met at Pagan Futures. And it was, yeah, it was good to meet you, Callum. Smart cities, a global ID system, centralized digital currencies, all of these things are currently being rolled out, or at least seem to be around the corner. Yes, they are. Correct. To what extent could privacy-centric cryptocurrencies like Monero be used in the future? Could this serve as a means to establish decentralized communities away from a future of total surveillance control? Yes and no. Some of you may know, and some of you may not know, that I run a Telegram group and have done on Telegram for 2 years called CryptoNats. And the idea with that was I saw an opportunity for people, for ordinary people like us, to profit from the predicted rise of cryptocurrency prices. Unfortunately, at the time of recording this episode, that prediction seems to have fallen flat on its face. And I'm sorry to say that, but cryptocurrencies have not performed as well as almost anyone expected them to over the last couple of years. And most people who bought cryptocurrencies in the last, well, certainly in the last year, 18 months, are down on their investment. But, you know, that's a side point, because anyone who dabbles in cryptocurrency as an investment should always have realized that there's nothing's guaranteed. You don't invest any money that you can't afford to lose, etc. But then there's another side to cryptocurrency, other than the side where we are trying to secure ourselves financially, which hopefully will still be an opportunity in the future. But, you know, at the time of recording this, it doesn't seem to be a realistic option. But there is another side to cryptocurrencies, which is privacy coins. And Monero, which Callum mentioned, is the flagship privacy coin. Now, just very briefly, anyone who doesn't know anything about cryptocurrency, the likes of Bitcoin, etc., 99.5% of cryptocurrencies are trackable on an open ledger. What that means is that you can see every transaction which is made between any cryptocurrency wallet address. So you don't know who that address belongs to, but if you are ever able to find that out, and there may be means of doing that, because cryptocurrency exchanges where people have to sign up using their real name and information, and then they purchase their first Bitcoin there, and then they send it to another wallet of theirs somewhere else, etc. That whole chain of transactions is tracked. So theoretically, an exchange could well be able to find out which addresses, plural, belong to which names, which people. So it is therefore possible if you own Bitcoin, for almost anyone in the world, particularly governments and central banks, to know how much Bitcoin you own, who you've sent it to, you know, where you've received it from, etc. And there are already cases where certain Bitcoin addresses have been blacklisted because they have been proven to be involved with crime or money laundering. And certain exchanges will now block Bitcoin that has ever been at that address from being received. So Bitcoin is already compromised in that, from that point of view. Now, in contrast, Monero is not. Monero cannot be tracked because every time a transaction takes place, there is the initial transaction, the initial sending of that Monero goes to unknown addresses, which are then somehow, through some complex programming means, which I can't explain, then goes to a specific wallet. So whilst you do have a specific address for yourself, it cannot be tracked whenever Monero is sent from one address to another. So in the future, you know, what I foresee is in the next few years, governments will start to roll out central bank digital currencies. These will essentially be cryptocurrencies which are issued by the central banks. People will probably be assigned a wallet automatically, and they will probably be given a certain amount of that currency every month, or maybe just to begin with, they'll be given like a starter amount to use. And this will eventually become the UBI, the Universal Basic Income. This is to encourage people to use that CBDC. And the reason that this is so important, and this is such a large part of the agenda that's currently at play and has been, you know, on overdrive for the last couple of years, the reason this is so important to the powers that be is it will give them the ability to program money. So they will be able to not only see what you spend your money on, who you send it to, where you spend it, in which geographic location you spend it. They'll not only be able to do that, they will actually be able to, through the use of what's called smart contracts, which I won't go into now, they will actually be able to prevent you from sending, for example, more than a certain amount of said CBDC to, you know, say a fast food retailer. You know, they'll say, nope, you've reached your limit this month. You are only allowed to buy, you know, £20 worth of fast food this month. I mean, maybe that wouldn't be such a bad thing, but that's just the thin end of the wedge, because it will eventually result in things like a certain book publisher who is verboten, you know, by the state, by the technocrats, and you will not be able to send your digital currency to them. And your old currency, you know, you'll no longer be able to send that digitally, because that's eventually been replaced by this new CBDC. You know, they want to phase out the old fiat money system, and they're going to make it increasingly difficult for people to use that. I mean, already fewer and fewer places are accepting cash. And, you know, over the next few years, well, over the first few years of the CBDC being rolled out, many places will stop accepting fiat digital currency, and they will only be accepting the new digital currency, the new central bank digital currency, the crypto so-called currency. And, you know, it will probably reach a point where, you know, you cannot buy more than a certain amount of fuel for your car every month, because that's unsustainable. You will not be able to, you know, perhaps it may even be that your central bank digital currency expires at the end of every month. So you've only got a month to spend it. And then after that, it's gone. Whatever's left in there is gone, so that you don't have the ability to save, because saving money is somehow unsustainable, according to Agenda 21's unsustainable goals. I mean, this is years down the line, of course, and, you know, I'm kind of describing a worst case scenario here, but unfortunately, I do think that that is where it's ultimately headed. It's just a question of how long until it gets there, and whether we as a people put up any resistance to this in the meantime, which is yet to be determined. But if this does roll out, if this does happen, then Monero will be a viable alternative to this. You will be able to transact with people remotely across the other side of the world without having to use the central bank issued digital currency. So you will still be able to buy those verboten books from the verboten book publisher. You will still be able to, you know, pay for services or make donations to dissidents at the other side of the world. You will still be able to do these things. Whether something like Monero alone can provide a viable alternative, I'm more skeptical about, because I think it will only be useful for remote transactions. I can't really see how it will be used commonly. You know, say if you go to your local farmer to get milk from the cows that he's just milked. I'm not sure whether it's ever going to be viable to then pay him using Monero. Maybe it will, or maybe in those local situations, it will be a pure barter state of affairs rather than any kind of currency being exchanged. The real question is, those expenses that we have, particularly the ones that are related to the government, for example, taxes and fines and things like that, the government are, of course, never going to accept Monero, ever. So if they're only accepting the official currency of the nation, then obviously Monero is no good there. So I think it will be a mixture. I think we will need to use both the official currency as well as something like Monero. Absolutely, I think Monero will be useful in the future. I hold, you know, a decent chunk of Monero myself, and I'm not selling it, no matter how low the fiat value of it goes. It doesn't matter. That I see that as a practical investment for the future. And, you know, we'll see. We'll see how things pan out. I definitely think we need to establish decentralized communities away from this surveillance control system. No question about that whatsoever. Whether those are based on barter system, whether they're based on some kind of just mutual assistance, whether they're based on, you know, self-made currencies of some form, whether they are or maybe even based on Monero, whatever, I don't know. But they are, they will be essential, because I don't see how a free and dignified humanity can exist without these breakaway communities. I just don't see how we can maintain any dignity or tradition or spiritual worldview or freedom or health or anything like that, if we are to live as part of the prevailing mainstream system. So all of us, our goal, our ambition should be to move towards these more self-sufficient communities. They will have to be rural, almost certainly. But yeah, I won't go into that in too much detail. Hopefully that's pretty well thoroughly answered Callum's question. So yeah, thank you very much, everyone, for submitting your questions. And yeah, I didn't actually think that this would go on as long as it has. And I hope you found my answers to them interesting. If this turns out to be a popular episode, then, you know, I'll do more AMA episodes in the future. You know, maybe every 10th episode will be an AMA, something like that. That'd be cool. I enjoyed doing this. I enjoy talking about these different subjects, which, you know, kind of challenge me and force me to offer something of value, which is what I strive to do anyway. Anyway, let us move on to the final section of the podcast, which is where I read out a riddle from the Old English Exeter Riddle Book. Last episode's riddle was number 9, and the answer to that one was cuckoo. So I don't know how many of you got that, but yeah, looking back over the riddle, I suppose it makes sense with lines such as, graciously fitted me out in soft garments, as kind to me as to her own children, tended and took me under her wing, until under shelter, unlike her kin, I matured as a mighty bird. So that's, I guess that's a reference to the cuckold habit of cuckoos, where other birds are forced to take care of the cuckoo. And the next riddle for this episode, episode number 10, riddle number 10, is as follows. My beak was bound and I was immersed. The current swept round me as I lay covered by mountain streams. I matured in the sea, above the milling waves, my body locked to a stray, floating spar. When, in black garments, I left the waves and the wood, I was full of life. Some of my clothing was white when the tides of air lifted me. The wind from the wave then carried me far over the seal's bath. Say what I am called. So there we go. Do your best to guess the answer to that one, and you'll find out in next week's episode. And for now, I thank you all very much for listening. And I hope you've enjoyed this episode as much as I enjoyed recording it. And I shall speak to you all again in the next episode.